When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's LiesOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers, Madison Firefighters, Local 311. Also, our local friends from the Teamsters, Local 365, and Madison Teachers Incorporated. John Nichols from the Capital Times with us. Boy, a lot's happened since we last talked. I've been on vacation. I was in Canada.
Yeah.
You've been watching what's going on, but we've got to start with the president's rally in Montana last night. These are just, let me just play these all for you, and then you can react collectively. Here's clip one.
Because we are finally putting America first. We're putting America first. You know, all the rhetoric you see here, the 1,000 points of light. What the hell was that, by the way? 1,000 points of light. What did that mean? Does anyone know? I know one thing. Make America great again, we understand. Putting America first, we understand. 1,000 points of light. I never quite got that one. I'm trying to say, what the hell is that? Has anyone ever figured that one out? And it was put out by a Republican, wasn't it? Let's say I'm debating Pocahontas, right? I promise you I'll do this. I will take, you know those little kits they sell on television for $2? Learn your heritage. In the middle of the debate, when she proclaims that she's of Indian heritage because her mother said she has high cheekbones, we will take that little kit and say, but we have to do it gently. Because we're in the Me Too generation, so we have to be very gentle. And we will very gently take that kit, and we will slowly toss it, hoping it doesn't hit her and injure her arm. Even though it only weighs probably 2 ounces. And we will say, I will give you $1 million to your favorite charity, paid for by Trump, if you take the test and it shows you're an Indian, you know. And let's see what she does, right?
That's the man who's going to pick the next Supreme Court justice to the United States.
That's a good. That is an extremely good juxtaposition there, Sly. Well done. It's like you never know where to go with all of that, but you really just took it to an appropriate spot because, obviously, in addition to being ignorant and cruel, and often pointless, not to mention sexist and a whole bunch of other things, he has power.
And a lot of it.
Yeah, and the power to pick a Supreme Court justice, name a Supreme Court justice, when your party has control of the Senate, is, you know, one of the greatest powers afforded by the founders. It's an amazing thing. And I can assure you, without a question, that he is about to abuse it, right? He's going to use it for ill, not for good. And there's so much to take apart in that lengthy segment. Number one, the fact that there's a bunch of people in Montana cheering for Donald Trump sort of lowers my opinion of Montana. Does it not yours?
Well,
because I like Montana.
I like Montana. I like Montana really, as well.
I respect it greatly. Now, admittedly, when a bunch of Wisconsinites are cheering for Trump, it doesn't exactly, you know, it doesn't exactly increase my impression of Wisconsin. But, you know, the thing is, I guess the saddest part about Trump in that whole soliloquy is the staggering lack of knowledge he has of politics. And you and I, in fairness, we're political geeks. We're, you know, like tragic, right, in this regard. But at least we bothered for a lot of our lives to kind of, you know, pay attention to this thing. And you generally would think that someone who became president of the United States might have bothered to pay attention to this.
First of all, everyone knows Walter Mondale won his home state in
Minnesota
in 1984.
But, see, a lot of people didn't note that, though, right? They just have noted recently that he's been saying this wrong, that he got Wisconsin wrong, right? That, you know, he didn't have the Wisconsin storyline.
Donald Trump didn't even win Minnesota.
No, I know. So the storyline doesn't work unless you have it wrong. Which is the point I'm getting to, which I think is my favorite point. is when Trump sets up a big story and is really kind of delivering, you know, his punchline, his powerful line, it only works if two things are in play. Number one, what he's saying is wrong. And number two, that he's speaking to an audience that doesn't know that he's wrong.
Well, I imagine there were some people in that audience that knew that he was wrong, but I don't think they care.
Oh, well, clearly there's people that don't care. But you see, it would kind of fall flat if, you know, like the majority of the audience was like, well, hold it, that's not right. You know, but the thing of it is we as a people, and it's not to pick on the audience, it's to say, in fairness, we assume that our political leaders know a little something about politics. And he doesn't. He is really deeply ignorant. It's part of why he will pick a lousy Supreme Court justice. And it maybe, is part of why he could get beat in this fight, which would, of course, drive him nuts. I'm not sure he fully understands that if he picks a super hardliner, a really bad player, as several of the potential candidates are, he is going to push Susan Collins across the line. Potentially, if Democrats can hold their own, even Lisa Murkowski. And there's a chance, and because McCain may be missing from the vote because of his illness, there's a chance he could get beat on this thing. And the key to that is that Trump pick a bad player. Now, admittedly, anybody he picks is probably going to be a bad player, but somebody who's so obviously such that you can turn a couple Republicans against. So this is big deal stuff we're talking about. But if we can get on one final element there, the Elizabeth Warren soliloquy, don't you think every time he does that, that it really is, you know, almost, it's, you're never quite sure whether he is terrified of her or whether he sees her as a worthy rival. But whichever it is, every time I hear him go through a soliloquy like that, I think, you know what? She really should run against him. Right. She should do it. Go for it.
Well, it kind of reminds me of what he did to President Obama. He trying to essentially dehumanize someone.
Right, and trying to you know, kind of drive home so-called points with an eye toward, you know, making that person the other, right? Somebody who doesn't fit in with the narrow, you know, whatever narrow scenario he's trying to draw. And it's an interesting game. It's not, I hate to say this, you know, because I don't get to compliment the president enough, but it's not dumb politics. There is a, you know, this game of demonizing the other has worked historically in this country and others. But it is an interesting thing because if you telegraph it this early, right, if he keeps banging on about this, I don't think it's going to be all that effective if, perchance, Elizabeth Warren were to run against him, right? You know, because for one thing, she's explained it very well. For another thing, Native Americans have, by and large, not all, admittedly, but have, by and large, said they understand her explanation. A lot of folks have said they respect it. And a lot of folks have noted that she's been a real champion for Native Americans. She stood up for them on a host of issues, for the communities and tribes on a host of issues. And so if he wants to play that game, you know, so be it.
What is the purpose of belittling George Herbert Walker Bush's 1,000 points of light?
Well, first off, this is a grown man who can't get a basic metaphor, right? 1,000 points of light. How hard is that, Sly?
No, it's not hard.
It's not very hard. You know, it's like, yeah, you can have the bright sun and that will guide you, or you can have 1,000 points of light. Everybody can contribute. It was actually, in fairness to Bush, one of the nicer things he came up with. And I think it was Peggy Noonan that came up with it, right? I don't know that for sure. I'm not sure of that, but you know what I mean? It had that poetic flavor.
Bush was trying to put a stamp on his version of republicanism. Reagan had become viewed as too harsh,
yeah.
So he tried putting his own brand on it. And there was an aspect of that. You know, he was originally from Connecticut. He was never quite as comfortable with the sort of Texas brawl as some others. But you know, it's so ridiculous, and I'll use the word pointless, to be attacking George Herbert Walker Bush. But I think that
at this point, especially. But you know what I think it's rooted in is I think he truly, passionately despises the Bushes. And I think he despises the Bushes for two reasons. Number one, they have had political privilege that he has never had. And I think he is, as you know, when he talks about the states he won and, you know, landslides and stuff like that, he's obsessed with his political ineptitude, his political weakness. And I think it does trouble him that there's this family that for whom it's been relatively easy. But secondly, I think that Trump despises a politics that tries to be uniting. I think he really sees it as weak, ill-informed, badly constructed. It's just, to him, it makes no sense, and he doesn't like it. And the Bushes, one thing, you love the Bushes or hate them, every time that they have been in a position of seeking the presidency in a clean run, Bush the dad in 88, even back in 80 to some extent, but especially in 88, Bush the lesser in 2000, they always try to frame out a uniting message. So with Bush the dad, you've got kinder and gentler and, you know, a lot of uniting messages. With Bush the son, you've got compassionate conservatism. You understand what I'm saying is, to Trump, I think this sort of stuff is deeply unsettling because it makes no sense to him. He sees politics as blood sport, and you go to destroy the other. And so, yeah, I just don't think I do think he may be honest when he says he doesn't understand the term 1,000 points of light. It may, in fact, be true. It's just he is the only one who doesn't.
His Supreme Court pick, obviously he's going off a list from the Heritage Foundation. It kind of looks like...
Is it Heritage or Federalist?
The Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, I think there's a little bleed there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're all the same.
They really are. Yeah, it's true.
It looks like Barrett's kind of getting pushed aside. These other people, any thoughts on them?
Well, I'm really sorry that Diane Sykes isn't getting the hearing that she deserves. But can you imagine if he nominated Diane Sykes?
Well, that would
Wouldn't that be an interesting moment?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, on so many levels. If we're looking at who the candidates are, you've got a couple of players. I think he's going to pick a judge. That's a given. I don't think he's going to
pick Mike Lee.
What?
Pick Mike Lee.
Well, he's not picking Mike Lee. I'll tell you that right now. Do you know why?
I
can tell you exactly why he will never touch Mike Lee. Mike Lee is a Rand Paul constitutionalist, and Mike Lee actually takes the Constitution seriously. Lee and I may disagree on some interpretations, but Lee is for real on this stuff, and there is no way that Donald Trump is putting somebody who takes the system of checks and balances seriously put that person on the Supreme Court at this point in history. You understand what I'm saying?
I noticed they're keeping these judges away from Trump. Now, we know that Trump has gone out of his way to, excuse me, President Trump has gone out of his way to talk to people being nominated for federal judgeships or U.S. attorneys, which is very unprecedented. But I noticed they're going out of their way to keep these candidates away from Donald Trump.
Why?
So they know the optics. Well, they know. Look, all these judges are potential jurors for the future of Donald Trump's freedom.
Without a doubt. You know who's in charge of the impeachment, right? It's John Roberts.
Right.
No, but it's something else with it, too. I think, Trump has said that he's not gonna ask him about choice, right? Or about abortion rights. And I think that there's a whole bunch of problems when you get Trump in a room with someone, right? And where he starts rambling on and going. And, he'll have his private meetings with with the final contestants. And remember, he's going to announce this in very short order.
Yeah, Monday night. And well, just,
it'll be a theater thing.
Just like for the record, Anthony Kennedy was a plenty awful justice himself.
He's terrible. He's a terrible judge. Yeah. He was, you know, I hear people say, and people I really respect who will say, yeah, he kept a balance on the court.
No, he didn't.
Right? Well, he kept a balance between, you know, the 20th century and the 18th century. not in any kind of modern sense, you know. He prevented some very bad things from happening, and you give him credit for that. More power to him. But on economic issues, he moved the center of the court to the right on every issue. And that includes, by the way, many of the social issues that people give him credit for. I will give him his due that he was quite good on gay and lesbian rights, right? LGBTQ rights. I give him his due. On abortion, he was okay, but he wasn't exactly, exactly a champion.
Oh, the late-term abortion decision? Yeah, that was terrible.
He did his final decision, right, where, you know, they were doing all these fake clinics and stuff like that. I mean, he has a mixed record, better than some of his colleagues.
Well, he probably is better than Robert Bork would have been. We'll take a break. John Nichols with us in the Capital Times and the Nation at SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who's going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com. Welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. John Nichols, Associate Editor of the Capital Times, and with the Nation as well. John, your colleague Paul Fanlon wrote a piece about what happened in New York State. Let me just play a clip of, because it's so long since we talked, so much has happened. Let me play a clip of the upset in New York.
Some of the shock may have worn off today, but 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like the rest of her party, is still trying to make sense of her come-from-nowhere win.
We spoke to communities that had typically been, I think, dismissed, and they responded.
Ocasio-Cortez knocked off the fourth highest-ranking House Democrat, 10-term Congressman Joe Crowley, who had been considered an heir apparent to leader Nancy Pelosi.
And I respect the outcome.
Crowley may have underestimated his opponent, who until recently was working as a bartender and organizing for Bernie Sanders.
I wasn't born to a wealthy or powerful family.
Like Sanders, she considers herself a Democratic socialist.
The GOP tax cut, that alone could have paid for tuition-free public college for everyone in this country for 2 years.
Democratic leaders carefully parted ways with her today on her support for Medicare for All.
I support health care for all.
And her proposal to eliminate the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency.
Reform ICE, yes. That's what I think we should do. It needs reform.
Republicans, meanwhile, reveled in the upset.
A slovenly man named Joe Crowley got his ass kicked.
They said it showed that the socialist wing is ascendant in the Democratic Party.
Are they right about that?
No, they're not. It's ascendant in that district, perhaps, but I don't accept any characterization of our party presented by the Republicans.
Democrats note that Crowley is their only House incumbent to lose so far this year.
Joe is just a great guy, but I don't think he paid close enough attention to those constituents at home.
Yeah, sending a surrogate in for a debate, probably not a good idea.
Well, that's not a good idea. And then you're basically devoting all of your time to running for the next rung on the leadership ladder. You know, no, that's that's why he lost. I mean, the fact is, a couple things to understand. First and foremost, Crowley was not a terrible guy. Crowley was a relatively liberal, relatively decent Democrat.
I never paid much attention to him, frankly.
I followed him because, you know what, the fact is, I've been on radio with him. On, you know where I've been on radio with him? And you'll know this because you know our own history, you and I. Irish radio. He's a big deal on Irish radio.
Oh, sure, of course.
Yeah, he's an Irish guy, represents a lot of Irish folks. And frankly, because of his Irish background, was very, very good on immigration issues, on a lot of immigration issues. And so, not a terrible guy, but also not, you know, some sort of exciting, vibrant, dynamic leader. And, you know, what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did was she went to that district and she said, look, you know, you can have more dynamic leadership. You can have somebody who really gets in there and fights on economic and social issues, goes to the mat on it, and comfortably uses words like working class or terms like working class, which she did all the time. And that's a big deal. And the interesting thing was, if you look at the breakdowns, the analysis of the district, she won all over that district. She did do well among Puerto Rican voters, as she is of Puerto Rican background. She did well among African-American voters. She also did well on gentrifying, you know, middle-class white voters, you know, Anglo voters. You know what I mean? She actually was a across-the-board candidate. And I think the reason it worked is that there's an awful lot of people who want the Democratic Party in these very safe Democratic districts to be vibrant, to be exciting, to stand for them. And with all due respect to Nancy Pelosi, right, she's like, well, it may work in that district, right? Well, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi. You're from San Francisco.
Right.
And it's not like democratic socialism does really badly in San Francisco.
Right.
You know, I mean, so she's sort of I found that reaction on her part especially to be deeply, deeply tone deaf.
You know, on the other hand, it's a big, diverse country, and the Democratic Party should be a big, diverse party. Connor Lamb's not exactly the same. Right? So there's different people and different. So anybody that thinks just because of one victory that somehow you have to shape a narrative is that somehow that's a threat to winning.
That's what the party's going to be.
The party's going to be that somehow that's a threat to winning seats in the Midwest. Like, for instance, I don't agree with abolishing ICE. I really don't. I think I don't.
You know what,
I don't think that's a. I don't think it's a smart tactic.
I don't know.
I believe
you
in
know what it is. It's another way of saying reforming immigration.
Right.
That's what it is.
Right.
Doing it differently.
Anything that takes us off economic message right now, I have a real problem.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing too, by the way, about Ocasio-Cortez. If you look at the paperwork on her campaign, at what she was putting out and what she was talking about, it was a very, very economically sound message.
Oh, I would have voted for her in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people would have. And here's the bottom line slide. Whether you call it democratic socialism, whether you call it a progressive, whether you call it, you know, an FDR Democrat, you use lots of different terms. There is a baseline, right, that says that when you make choices about economic issues, a host of economic issues, you're going to do so on the side of the many, not the few. Very simple, basic construct. And you're going to adopt the FDR sensibility, which, by the way, most contemporary Democrats don't. It's one of the shocking things to me is how far this party has moved from its roots. You know, FDR said in 36, you know, all the economic elites, the bankers and all these guys are united in their hatred of me, and I welcome their hatred, right? He took a clear side. I'm always amazed, stunned, by former Democrats who will say, oh, I didn't leave the party. The party left me. Well, if you are saying that, what you are saying is that you have become some sort of right winger, right? You know, that it's like, and because, and I don't mean like a little bit right wing, I mean extreme, because the Democratic Party hasn't gone to the left on economics. It hasn't gone to the left on you know, battles against concentrated economic or political power. It's gone to the right. It's become a much more centrist party and, frankly, a much more boring party. And I think there's a lot of small, you know, just grassroots Democrats who want it to mean something.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not necessarily always a left-right paradigm.
It is.
There are Democrats that are more socially conservative that agree with Medicare for All.
Oh, and I'll tell you something else, too. Do you know what a friend of mine back a long time ago noted correctly that there is, in a lot of working-class communities, a Catholic social justice stream where you will find members of Congress who vote for abortion rights, who support a woman's right to choose, but frankly are not, you know, they're not the champions on the issue always. And but some of these folks turn out to be, you know, A, real outspoken figures on economic justice issues, take care of, you know, a special concern for the poor, and also on war and peace. It's quite notable that some of the members of Congress who are most dubious about, you know, running off to war someplace, are folks who you might not always identify on the traditional measures as lefties.
Before we go today, I want to ask you your thoughts and reflections on Ed Schultz, who passed away the other day.
Ed Schultz was the guy who showed up. I mean, it's a simple way of saying it. When he was given a platform with MSNBC to, you know, do a national show, he didn't initially have the best time slot, but he moved into a pretty good primetime time slot. And right after the 2010 Republican wave, obviously Scott Walker went to war with workers, attacked their unions, attacked, you know, union members, the public sector especially, attacked public education, attacked public services. And when that happened, Ed Schultz got on a plane as quick as he could, claimed a little corner of the square there, or a little side of the square there, and, you know, gave voice to something. And there's simply no question that when he showed up and gave voice to the Wisconsin uprising, that didn't start the uprising. It had already started, and it had already grown into something quite substantial. But much faster than just about anybody else in media, he recognized that. And that recognition paid off for him. It helped to identify him as the guy who got workers' struggles. And interestingly enough, he then showed up in Ohio when Ohio was fighting against their anti-labor law. He showed up in Freeport, Illinois, when you had the Sensata plant and the whole Bain Capital outsourcing issue. Again and again and again, he showed up.
He showed up.
That's a big deal.
He showed up to take on a president of his own party in fighting Barack Obama on TPP.
Yeah, yeah, without a doubt. And frankly, I think if you're honest about it and you say, okay, when Bernie Sanders announced for the presidency in 2015, would he have been able to get the traction that he did if he hadn't, for really the last 5 or 6 years, been a very regular guest on Ed Schultz's show, on both on television and on radio? I think that Ed Schultz helped to introduce Bernie Sanders to a much broader audience. And I think that was very, very important to the rise of, you know, an alternative politics in the Democratic Party. So people can dislike him. People can get mad at him and disagree with him and not like, you know, they ended up appearing on RT. But at some fundamental level, when there's a host of major struggles being fought, he showed up.
You know, last night on MSNBC, we're recording this as of Friday morning, both Chris Hayes and Joy Reid paid tribute to him, and you can, and I've been critical of both of them and their lack of attention to fighting for workers' rights and carrying on what Ed Schultz obviously fought for. But you can genuinely tell they had a great sense of loss. That they felt like, you know, even though he wasn't part of the MSNBC team anymore, that they lost someone of significance.
Without a doubt. And I think it, you know, it's different for different folks and what people tapped into. One thing that's important is that, you know, Chris Hayes really did come out of a background that had a lot of labor connections in it. And I think that, you know, he really, you could just feel with him a sense of, as he said, that he was really trying to get his head around losing Ed Schultz, you know, that this was something big and something, a genuine loss. And Joy Reid, you know, it's important to understand that some of the first shows that Joy Reid hosted, you know, where she would fill in for somebody, was Ed's show. I mean, and she was quite regular on as a guest. But more than that, too, Joy Reid has always cared about, and thankfully, about voting rights issues and about a host of justice issues. And that was a place where Ed was as well. I mean, I think we do talk about Ed a lot as a labor guy, and there's no question of that. But, boy, if you look back on the, you know, kind of the whole canon of his shows and all the shows that he recorded, there's a tremendous number of them that focused on voting rights, on civil rights. And if I can point out one final thing that's really interesting, he was a passionately pro-labor guy. When some of these pipeline issues started to develop out in the West, right, and you had, you know, real battles between usually native peoples on the ground and sometimes unions that wanted to get the work to construct those pipelines, Ed initially was a pro-pipeline guy. He tended to talk it up, and he got contacts from union or from Native Americans, from activists on the ground. They said, "Why don't you come out here?"
Oh, the farmers in Nebraska,
and farmers, and farmers. But they said, "Why don't you come out to Nebraska? Why don't you come out to the Dakotas?" You know, Ed Schultz on his own on a weekend went and met with Native Americans on the ground and with farmers and with others, and he switched his position and became one of the first people to really highlight some of those struggles.
I just have a minute left here. Let me ask you about his evolution. You knew him very well. I knew him a little. He treated me very well. But let me ask you, did he ever talk to you about his evolution? Because at one time he was a conservative talk show host.
Yep.
Why did he change?
It's very easy. I mean, it's a love story. He was on radio, and he was a very big deal in Fargo, where he's from. And he's still a big deal up there. Everybody, conservatives, liberals, everybody, you know, had a regard for him. They all knew him. So he's on radio, and he was saying something nasty about poor folks or folks who were in need. And this woman who was involved with food banks and with, you know, programs for dispossessed people calls in and says, you know, hey, you should really come and see, you know, the reality of folks that are in need. You ought to come and visit some of these, you know, shelters and places that are helping folks who've fallen on hard times. And Ed, being Ed, said, oh, yeah, okay, I'll come. And that was always his great thing, that if people said, we want you to come do this, he'd go do it. And it was Wendy. It was the woman he ended up marrying. And she showed him around. I think she touched his heart, not in a love element there, but also, you know, showed him the reality of what was going on with people who were dispossessed, people who were in hard times. And I think that, you know, that connection, what she showed him also did inspire him to fall in love with her. And he did. And, you know, I was texting with her yesterday, and they really had a remarkable love story. And it was, you know, there's no simple question. He would never, ever tell you anything else. That while he became steeped in a lot of these issues, that it was Wendy who brought him to the left.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
It's a pleasure, brother.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye bye.
Making stuff matters because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.